are now listening to the Serious Growth Podcast with your host, Leo Costa Jr.
Welcome to Serious Growth Podcast, where the truth will be told. On today's show, we have a gentleman who was on before. His name is Tony Pearson. And Tony, I know the last time you were on, we talked mainly about your training, which was awesome. I learned a lot about that. And then we wanted you to come back and talk about your book called Driven.
Yes.
And I got to tell you, man, we talked a little bit before the show. This book, it got me. Yeah, that one. That thing got a hold of me, man. I mean, I started reading it. It's like, oh my God, I can't stop reading this book. And I'm just going to say, I highlighted one thing here in like the what page was it on? It was like page 5.
Okay.
And I'll just let you go from there, if you will.
Okay.
Aunt Betty.
Yes.
God, go ahead, man. You tell me what you got to tell us, because this thing's amazing.
Well, I'm smiling, but it's really a tough.
I guess what I should ask you is, why did you write the book? Maybe that's a better question.
There's a lot of reasons I wrote the book. And one, the first is for myself, because you had this pent up emotions all these years, but you never expressed to anyone, not even girlfriends, not even, you know, no one. Yeah. So no one knew the story, the real story. Yeah. They see me, people tell me what they think of me. It's, oh, middle class, nice life, you win a lot of trophies, you had an easy life. And I'm saying to myself, if only they knew.
Right.
So after I turned, 61, I said, you know, I'm going to tell my story.
Yeah.
And the reason is, maybe I can help other people to tell their story and find some closure in their lives, because you have a lot of frustration, depression, anger, drugs, because you're trying to escape the truth.
Right. Yeah.
This is my truth.
Right.
I'm living my truth. And as an advocate for kids today, that's happening, 4 to 5 kids are abused or killed, die per day.
Wow.
By abuse from family members who's usually on drugs and alcohol.
Yeah.
And which is about, throughout the year, so more than 1,800 kids die a year from abuse, neglect, by family members or other people. And no one's drawing awareness to this. And I'm trying to advocate for the kids, because I was one, I went through it for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I could die any day within those 12 years. So you are at alert at all times.
Yeah, why don't you think that...
Bible mode.
Yeah, why don't you think that any awareness is brought to it? I mean, that's a lot of kids.
That's a lot of kids. People said, oh, 4 or 5 kids a day, it's not very much. Time 365, what we got?
Exactly.
This is every year, and this is happening every day in this country.
Yeah.
And no one is talking about this. You know, they got social media and all these beautiful people and all this. What about saving our kids?
Exactly.
They want to go to college. They want to after school programs. Let's save their lives first.
No kidding.
Because I was a victim, I know what it's like to be in that situation where you're hopeless, you're depressed, you're nobody, you don't exist, and you walk around like a zombie for 12 years. You have no voice.
Yeah.
Auntie Betty was cruel. You couldn't even show an expression on your face that you rejected something or you didn't like something. That's another beating for you. So this is
mental abuse, right?
It's mental. It is worse than the physical. The physical you can heal, but the mental, you know, you can't. You can't heal from it. So I'm thinking about the kids. I said, this is great for kids to give them hope, that there is hope, that you can survive, that you can, you know, bury yourself.
Yeah.
You can become a better person to yourself. You don't have to turn to drugs, crime, or go to jail or dead. You know, somebody wrote a review for me and he said he should be dead. How did he survive it? You know, he should be angry with the world.
Yeah.
But I'm not, because bodybuilding saved my life.
That's where you and I have the same story in that regard. That saved my life too.
Exactly. You know, certain people put me in the right place. I guess God put me in the right places, and I got a great trainer, and the rest is history. But I'm asking myself, what would I have done without bodybuilding?
Good question.
Where would I be?
Yeah.
You know, I barely made it through school. I was lost back in Missouri in the 70s. You know, in the 60s, I grew up in the civil rights. So I had every odd possible against me. As soon as I walk out the door, in the house, no matter where I was, my dad gave me away. I mean, it's just endless obstacles to overcome. Yeah. But I had such a will to live. And I think that's what kept me going. I just wanted to live. You know, when you're young, you're full of yourself, you think you are, and I just want to train, I want to win, and I just want to keep winning, and I just want to prove something.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I saw that was happening to you, I don't know if when you're a young age, you know, it's hard to know sometimes some of the lessons that you're learning that are more positive. As I'm reading your book, and I tell you that all the stuff that you were going through, like, is one thing after the other, and that mental abuse, I mean, I was feeling it through the book, you know.
Right.
But one of the things that I noticed is that along the way, you have these little surprises, little mentors that were helping you along. I don't know. Maybe you could tell us, did you actually, at that time, being that young, did you really, were you aware of that?
No.
Right. You know, how could you?
I was not aware of that. I mean, what are the chances of me making it to St. Louis and meeting Muhammad Ali and going to the gym for the first time? My wrestling coach said, let's go here. I mean, all these things, I look back as I was writing it, I'm going, oh, wow.
I know.
How could this be?
Yeah.
certain moments.
Yeah.
You know, then Muscle Beach, the situation with Arnold, it's just, how could this be? What are the chances, though? You couldn't script it.
No.
Hollywood can't create this. This is like miracles dropping from the sky.
It's true.
So, you're right. But I was, you know, I was, like I said, I was so determined. I was, had such a will to fight, but that was instilled in me as a child. I had to survive.
Right.
So every day I woke up with survival mode.
So let me say this, and obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm almost thinking that what you were actually going through, besides bodybuilding, what you were actually going through was actually part of your success because you did have that will to survive. I mean, I don't know where that will to survive came from. Did you have, did it come from like your dad or somebody that gave you that? Or was that just something that was just in you?
I think that was instilled in me because when you're 3 years old and you're near death, this is the day I grew up. I was never a child again because that fire woke me up and I go, I want to live. I'm survival.
Yeah.
So this is how I was raised, and you saw what I did every day after school and the work I had to do.
Yeah.
So in some way, it was conditioning me for that first trainer that I got.
Isn't that funny how you start realizing things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah. Because whatever he said, I did, and I never said no or I can't or I won't, because I knew if I did, he would have said, "There's the door. You can fucking take it."
Yeah. Was that George Turner?
George Turner, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So instinctively I knew not to say no to George.
Yeah.
So for 9 months, twice a day, you know, he beat me down, but he was getting me ready for California.
Right.
Preparing me for the greater battle that I'm gonna be dealing with. So
yeah.
So when I got to LA, it was like, okay, you know, was I terrified? Absolutely.
Yeah, you went with somebody too. By the way, before we talk about that, George Turner reminded me of Vince Gironda. I mean, the minute I saw the dialogue,
right?
Holy shit, this is Vince.
Right, totally, it's the Vince, that's right. Oh, yeah, God. No nonsense, in your face.
Oh, God, I love that. I mean, when the dialogue that was going on, that I was just, you had me going there. I was smiling and laughing. I thought, yeah, I like George Turner. I don't even know him, but I like him already.
Yes, he's a great character.
Yeah, and now you went out to California with somebody, right?
Yeah, my friend from high school, I convinced him to go because there's a lot of beautiful girls out there, beach, sunshine, paradise.
Yeah, you got to paint the vision.
Right, and he bought into it.
That's funny.
Problem is, he never got to see the beach.
I saw that. He just like, was a couple days, he said, fuck this, I'm going back home.
Yeah, he called mom. Mom sent him a ticket home, and there he's gone. So now I'm trapped downtown.
Wow.
At 19. After my sheltered life, so I had no experience in whatsoever.
God.
So here's another one of those moments. I have to talk about this moment.
Sure.
He leaves. Next day, I go to the emergency room because I think I'm having a heart attack. They're terrified.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm going to take the next bus. Wherever this bus takes me, that's where I'm going to go. I've never been to Los Angeles before. I don't know where I'm going.
Yeah.
What are the chances of getting on the right bus at the right moment, the right time, and the right day?
I know. I remember that part in your book.
It could have taken me to Pasadena, Watts, Compton, you name it, anywhere. But it took me to Beverly Hills.
I know.
Which is the direction where I needed to go.
Yeah.
So that's that. And then that kid sitting at the bus stop, it was like he was waiting for me to arrive. give me directions.
Yeah. You know, the thing about that is, Tony, you know, it's like, that sounds so, woo, you know, out there. Yeah. But that's how it works sometimes, because I've had some of those wow moments like that you're talking about. It's like, holy shit.
You can't explain it.
You can't.
No.
And I don't know if you should anyway, but it's something that obviously happens to you, and I relate to that, you know, because you could have gone anywhere.
Right.
How old were you at that time?
I was 19.
19 years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you imagine 19 years old and you thought you were having a heart attack? Oh, my God.
Yeah. I was really couldn't breathe. I was like huffing and puffing, just grabbing my chest, the whole thing, sweating profusely. Yeah. And the nurse said, you're hyperventilating. You're having a heart attack.
Damn, no.
What happened to you? She goes.
Yeah.
And I explain my situation. She goes, I understand.
Tony, at this point now, you only had like $5-10 in your pocket, right? You had no money.
I had about $9 left. Because for the 10 days we sat in the hotel, we spent the money every day.
Right.
The money, he was broke. That's why he ran home. He had to go home.
Right.
And I said, I'm not going anywhere. This is it. This is a decision I've made. I'm going to live or die in LA, is what I said. There's nothing to go back to.
Exactly. The motivation was greater than the obstacle.
Exactly. There was nothing to go back to. I knew that. I mean, St. Louis in the mid-70s, it's a good place to be from.
You know something? I didn't realize. This is how stupid I am. I mean, you know, you and I are about the same age. I'm a little bit older than you. But I didn't realize that in the 70s, it was like that back then. I didn't.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, yes.
Crazy stuff. But that's a strong motivator. I can give you another example. I mean, listen, my story compares nothing to yours, because I'm thinking, the point that I'm trying to make is, I was born and raised on a dairy. And that was hard labor, baby. I mean, our parents used, I'll say it like it is. We were used as cheap labor.
Yes.
Okay. And we worked our asses off.
Yes.
But guess what, Tony? When I got a chance to do a job where I had air conditioning and heating inside of a gym, I thought, well, I'm not ever going back to that life.
Right.
This is so much easier than this, no matter how hard this gym life is, it can't compare to that.
Exactly.
Sounds like very much like what you're saying, right?
No, you experienced the worst. So
now
it's not so bad.
That's all perspective, isn't it?
Exactly. So when things got really tough in California, I was homeless for a while.
Yeah, so I remember that.
I remember back where I came from. And I said, I'm in California. Somehow I'm going to make it in California. I kept believing that.
Yeah.
But still, it's not as bad as the cotton field.
Right. Perspective. That's right. For sure. So then you got off the bus, and that guy gave you directions to, was it Gold's Gym?
Gold's Gym, the original Gold's Gym.
Yeah.
And I made my way down there, and I got thrown out.
That's right. Now tell the audience, or the people that are listening, or why did they throw you out?
I couldn't afford the membership.
Okay. What was the membership back then?
I think it was like $30 for the month.
Yeah.
You know, maybe 40 max. I had $8 left.
Now, when you got there, did they throw you out immediately when they knew you couldn't?
No, no. I walked in. It had to be 6 weeks before a contest, the Olympia. I mean, I saw Robbie Manuel Perry, Kenny Waller, Joe Weider was there taking pictures with Frank Zane that day.
That's golden, man.
You're right. And I saw all these guys train. I went and sat in the corner on the floor and watched it for about 45 minutes, just watching these guys work out. No one was talking. There was no water drinking. All you could hear was weights moving.
Yeah.
I mean, they were serious, stone faced, training like madmen.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there, my eyes is big, and oh my God.
I bet.
I'm in heaven.
I bet.
I saw them on television, and they're in front of me.
Yeah.
And then about 45 minutes later, the manager says, get over here, kid. He goes, where the hell are you from? And I go, can I buy a membership? No, I said, can I work out for the day? I just want to work out. Can you buy a membership? I said, no, and you got to leave.
Really?
Walk me to the front door.
And who was the manager? Do you remember his name?
I think it's Dan Howard. I'll never forget his name.
Yeah, I thought you might remember
Dan
that.
Howard. Yes.
I would remember his name if I was in your shoes with all those pros there and I got asked and I got tossed something and oh man, one of these days.
You know, he's looking at some kid, 19 years old, practically no muscles, just drifting into this gym. You know, what are you doing here? What do you want?
Yeah.
You can't buy a membership. You got to leave.
Yeah.
Or you're a kid. That's what he said. We can't have you hanging around the gym.
Wow.
So yeah, I made my way to Muscle Beach.
Yeah.
So I'm found the weight pit, the weight pen.
Yeah.
And I saw this picture you read about, Cal Skalik.
Yeah.
Poster on the wall, his massive chest. And I knew Arnold trained down there, but not that day. And I worked out, and that was it. I trained at Muscle Beach. It was like $3 for the week.
There you go.
And the guy didn't charge me. He says, go ahead, work out, kid.
Right. So, I remember that part in the book. So now, do you remember that guy's name?
No, he was the guy in the office, just running the office down.
Oh, okay. It's probably the same office that's still there. There's like
the same office. No, the office is still there.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Building the same office, yes.
Yeah.
The only thing they removed are two telephones next to the office. Remember pay telephones?
Yeah.
Back in those days. Away. Right, yeah.
Right, yeah.
That's still there.
Hey, did they call that, because I when I first went down there, and we talked about this on the last show that you and I did, is I ended up down there at Muscle Beach because obviously I heard about all that. Now, right. Muscle Beach, I think when I got down there, obviously it was like in the late 80s, was different than when you were there, correct?
Completely different, yes. They redid the whole thing.
Did they call that the weight pin? Because you're using specific words. So I'm just wondering if that was what it was called.
It was the weight pin.
Weight pin.
Yes. That's what I wrote. Some people call it the weight pit, but it's the weight pen.
Weight pen. Let's get this right, for goodness sake. Pen.
Yeah.
To be accurate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you started training there. Like, were there big names that were actually training there during those days?
Yeah. I mean, Arnold came down to almost every day.
Is that right?
Yeah. There's tons of pictures of him working out there.
So, like, and I did see some, obviously, some him working out there, but and this is somebody who doesn't know. Were guys working out in those days at the weight pen? Was it more for, were they really training, or was it about being seen working out?
It was a combination of both, because it was such a new thing to watch these guys work out. So you had thousands of people standing around the weight pin watching you work out.
Love it.
So it was this part show. The music is blasting in the background.
Love it. Yeah, love it.
I mean, it was like, it was a moment. And all of those guys who worked out, like Charles Glass, who's down there.
Yeah.
They became champions.
Yeah.
Whoever... One, Mr. Venice Beach, went on with Mr. Los Angeles and moved on to California. Yeah.
Kind of a launching pad.
Yeah. It was like some real quality guys down there.
Yeah.
I mean, just to win the Venice Beach, you had to be.
Hey, they still have that Venice Beach, Mr. Venice Beach. They still have that.
Yes. They have every holiday. You have the Mr. Venice Beach competition, and it's crowded, but not the same quality of guys.
Yeah.
These guys were moving up. They're going somewhere.
Yeah. Now, were these guys doing during? Because again, I'm reflecting back on the books that I read or the magazines. These guys used to perform like feats of strength, didn't they? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were they do that in Santa Monica, or is that actually at the weight pit?
That was in Santa Monica.
Ah, that's what I thought.
That was long before. Yeah.
Okay.
They moved it down to Venice.
Got it.
You know, acrobatic stunts and all these things.
Right.
I've seen pictures of it. Yeah.
Yeah, because that's what I saw too. I wasn't sure exactly, you know, if they were doing that kind of stuff right there at the weight pit. So back then, Tony, were there any women working out in the weight pit? Is all males?
Mostly, I would say 90% men.
Yeah.
There was a few women there, but it was not accepted.
Let me tell you something. I think, from my perspective, I think that when they upgraded the weight pit, I think they ruined it for me. I like the old.
You like the old one.
I like the old one, man.
The original.
Yeah. I went down to one day and said, fuck, they ruined it for me. We put all this new equipment in there, or looked newer than that other stuff. I mean, that other stuff was like ancient, right?
Ancient and rusty.
And all rusty. That.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like the padding on the upholstery is all screwed up.
Oh, when it's raining and all the weights outside.
Yeah. Oh, man.
No, I love that place. I really love. I would walk down there every single day. That was my walk, and I had a little tiny apartment, like maybe half a mile up the boardwalk.
Okay, so then let me ask you this. Okay, now you went from having $7 or $8 in your pocket.
Right.
So how did you have a because I'm jealous, because I want a damn place down there. How did you have a place on, off the boardwalk at that point? How are you?
No, that came later.
Oh, okay.
It came much later, yes. I made my way to Gold's Gym, and I met some of the pros, and they got me a job, and they started helping me out. I was working security, had my little suit and tie on. Everything.
There you go.
You get $7, $5 an hour.
Yeah.
So I met, and the apartment was like $100 a month.
Really?
In those days, it was a studio, a little tiny apartment.
Yeah, those are like $1,000 or $2,000 a month now.
I know. Yeah, it's kind of a dump, you know. It was kind of the hood.
Yeah.
So, but it's right off the boardwalk. So I would walk the boardwalk every day. And when that was when the roller skating was popular, the disco roller skating.
Oh, yeah.
Teams down there competing all the time.
Hey, do you know that guy? Hold on to your thought, but this guy, that guy that's been down there for probably 100 years, he's on roller skates and he plays a guitar.
There?
He's still there.
No.
Yeah, he's still there.
Oh, I remember him completely. He was there every day.
He's 1,000 years old right now, and he's still skating on those skates, playing a guitar.
Yeah. But he'd never aged.
He didn't.
He did. Sing.
Yeah.
1976, I remember this guy, and he would stop all the girls and sing to them. Yeah. And he roller skated with roller skates.
He's still doing it, man. Last time I was down there, he was still doing that stuff. I figured you might know what I'm talking about.
Totally. I never knew his name, but.
Yeah, I don't know his name either, but you know who I'm talking about.
Dan thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's crazy. I know. I love going down there I could just sit there on the boardwalk and just right there is all the entertainment that I need. I can hang out there all damn day long.
Pure entertainment. And I tried to bring that alive in my book.
You
I
did.
Talk about the wardrobe and the clothes and the music and this and that.
Oh, yeah.
Put you in Venice in the mid-70s.
You painted a really good picture. So you're in the weight pit during this time. And did you actually get ready for your first show by being a member at the weight pit? Or when did you transition into being that? You were at Gold's, obviously, weren't you?
Later on.
So tell me how you kind of worked up. You know, you got ready for your first show training in the weight pit then.
After Arnold discovered me, it really put me on the right path. It made me really focus on what I wanted to do. Yeah, I wanted to be a bodybuilder when I get to California, but I was distracted and I was starving. Yeah. But after Arnold, you know, situation, I go, this is what I'm going to do. So my friend says, Mr. Venice Beach is coming up. I go, yeah, that's it. Yeah. So here we go. That's how I got started.
Yeah.
So I won that. And then I made my way to Gold's Gym eventually.
Okay, but did you have somebody helping you along the way to help you win that show, to help you start getting a show? It's a process, right?
It was a process. No, genetically, thank God, I was pretty structure-wise there. I brought my legs, and the legs were, you know, bigger, stronger, and my waist was super small, and I was really cut all the time.
Yeah.
Here's my diet. A week before the show, I went to Santa Monica and ran around the track 4 times. That named me out.
So, oh, God.
That was my diet.
Oh, you're one of those guys.
Yeah. Now, that was then. Now I have to starve a little bit. Well, I have to read the workout.
Boy, that's a cruel joke, isn't it?
Yeah.
All the time you put in, you would think at least I could have like, you know, I could eat like a couple thousand calories a day or more.
I barely eat now. So at age 19, I was shredded to the bone. And then at 63, here I am, so I have to diet. Now the diet starts.
Exactly. You have to work a lot harder for it.
A lot harder, yes.
Okay, so then you win Mr. Venice Beat.
Yeah, and then I started competing in all those LA. I did the LA Junior Mr. LA. I did the Gold's Classic Teenage Class, which I won.
Yeah.
And then this is Southern California, I won, and made my way to the California, Mr. California.
So was that a big wake-up call for you when you got to the Mr. California?
Huge. The Junior Mr. USA 1977, Lincoln, Nebraska. I got third in my class.
That tore you up, right? I remember that you walked away like with your head down, right?
That destroyed me.
And yet, this is how high you had your standards set for yourself, because in the top three the first time around, if you look back now, I think it's pretty damn remarkable, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, but no. I was devastated by this.
I know. I remember that.
Then, so my training partners went through hell after that, because we're going to train. Someone's going to die here today, and this is every day. So,
shit.
I've conditioned to work at that level, and that's all I knew. And when you're starving, you train a little bit harder.
Oh, yeah.
Because you exactly. Well, you got it. Well, you have no choice. You have no choice.
Yeah.
But I was doing it.
I'm going to tell you a little secret, maybe. You know that when you're training animals, I used to train horses when I got out of, I became a rodeo person and I trained horses. You always train your animals on an empty stomach because they work better than they do when their stomach is full. Sound like to me that you were that animal that was.
Yes.
Yes.
Stomach was empty.
Empty.
You're right.
There's a whole different attention span right there.
Completely. Yeah. I burned out a lot of training partners. Trust me.
How many did you have when you were training? One or two all the time, or how that
usually
work?
One-on-one. Sometimes there's two, but that takes more time. It uses one-on-one.
Oh yeah.
It's one-on-one. And then yeah. I transitioned. I started training with Robbie. He invited me to train with him. So that was a battle. This is training with the madman.
Yeah.
With no emotions. He would just destroy. He destroyed his training partners. Oh man. Before I used to sit back and watch how he would beat them to the ground.
Really?
Oh yeah. He never missed a beat.
I guess they're marking the really top bodybuilders to see how many trainers he left dead in his path.
Yeah, I wasn't intentional, but, you know, we got to work. We here to work.
This is how it goes.
We're squatting at 9 plates on the leg press each side. We stand up, 100-pound lunges, supersetting back and forth.
Oh, God.
T-bar row, superset with pull-ups. It was seated cable roll. It was just crazy, crazy stuff.
And, you know, I'm going to assume that I've been an athlete and I know how energy, you know, when you're around a certain energy, I would imagine that just being in that environment, you guys just fed off each other, right?
Exactly. All your competitors in the same room. Yeah. I see Tom Platz over there. I see Samir over there. I see, you know, all these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you're going to train a little bit harder.
Right. So keep walking us down this path. I read your book, but I want you to tell the story. So what was that? So you took third place and you were devastated and all hell was going to break loose now because this wasn't going to happen again. Did you go back and compete in that same show again?
No, I never went back to compete. Anything I lost, I kept moving forward.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you don't go back.
No kidding. I would have thought you want to go back and say, there, I got to check it off of your box. No.
That was 77, but I won in 78. I did go back. I won in 78. Yes.
Okay. Yes. And so then once you run, that was obviously that was the biggest show then in your career.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what was your next move? Now, at this point, were you still making a living doing odd jobs while you were training bodybuilding?
Yeah. Most of security work. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's, I call that perfect willingness. When you're willing to do that kind of stuff, you know, most people don't have that, Tony. They just don't.
True.
You know, but obviously the passion, there's a lot of motivation that was going to overcome all that. You're a pure testament to that. So the next show that you did then, what was that one?
So that was 78 in Lincoln, Nebraska. I got beat up really bad. 77. So the 78 was a good year for me. I won the LA Open men, and then I won the Junior USA, Junior Miss America, Miss America. So that was the turnaround year. Okay. But when I went home in 77, my body changed. My body changed because my mindset changed.
How so?
I got bigger. I grew. And everyone said he really transformed. I mean, he really put some muscle on. We trained. I was determined to show that I'm better than third place.
Okay, so then your mindset changed, like more intense. You had a different
intense.
Kind of,
yeah. Yes. I mean, I got very serious about the training. Just like when I walked in Gold's Gym that first time and I watched those guys, I said, look at their face. They were very, very serious.
Yeah.
This is their job, very intense, and they were lifting some heavy weight with no rest in between.
Yeah.
See, all these guys today think they're strong. I like to take them to the gym and give them 4 or 5 on the deadlift, set to 12. You got 30-second rest, now let's do it again.
Yeah, over and
that
over again.
That proves how strong you are because your endurance level.
Yeah.
You're not 2 minutes between sets, 3 minutes, really? Yeah. You got 45 seconds.
Yeah, what do you mean? Okay, so let me stop you right there for just a moment because I want to go back a little bit.
Okay.
Because one of the things I did notice in your life that was starting to happen, these women started coming into your life, you know? And why don't you, if you want to talk about that, because what I noticed, and here's how I can relate to you a little bit, by the way. I noticed that you had women that came into your life, but it was just something that just didn't last.
Right.
It was because of the nature of the beast of your sport.
Yes.
So at this stage of the game, were you on your, was it second girlfriend? Because I can't, I don't remember exactly how many at this point that you had. I just remember that it was really tough. My bodybuilding career was very tough on my first relationship, and it broke up.
Yeah.
I made that choice. I said, you know, this means, I hate to say it, but this is the most important thing in my life.
Yes.
And I had kids, and that I'm not saying that they weren't important.
Right.
In terms of my work, it was the number one thing in my life because that's how I was going to make some money off of it.
You know? Right. For me, it was becoming a job.
Yeah.
And the first girlfriend was around when I won the American. And I remember we said, I'll see you when the show's over.
Yeah.
This is it for me.
Yeah.
And that's why relationships never worked out. I mean, bodybuilding was the first thing on the list, and women don't like me in second place.
Right.
And she says, all you do is train, eat, and sleep. Yes.
Yep.
I have a contest coming up.
Correct.
That's not what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Right.
They end up leaving. You got to realize we were young, though, these young people.
Yeah.
I'm 18, 20, 21. They're like 18, 19, so they're still kids.
Right. And then on top of that, you're starting to do seminars and guest appearances and things like that. So in addition to you competing in shows, you're doing other things to make money, right?
Exactly. So you're on tour, seminars, exhibitions, all these things. Yeah. And you have to be in shape.
Yeah.
Never once did I guest post out of shape.
And you're not going to be asked to come back very many times if you come
back. Not going back.
Right.
No. So it only takes one time to kill. And they all know each other. Promoters call each other.
Oh, yeah.
Look.
Small group.
How was his show?
Yeah.
So.
Okay. So who else in your, did in your, again, getting back to your book, you had Aunt Betty seem to be somebody who was in your life one way or the other for quite some time. Yes. And I know you guys at the end, it seems like you came to terms with each other.
Right.
But who else was in your life at that time that was, I know you had a sister was, she would seem to find you no matter where you were. She'd
yes.
She'd find yeah. you. But was there anybody else in your life that was, would you say that was, that stood out as being toxic maybe in your life? Because one of the things I've tried to do in my life is, you know, I had enough toxic in my lifetime, but I also knew that I didn't want some of that at a certain point. And I just started like make this, this became a point where I said, okay, you and this type cannot be involved in my life any longer. And yet, because you had to tolerate some of that as you were growing up. Was that the case? Like, you know, along the way, were there anybody that was still kind of holding you back because they just didn't understand Tony Pearson and they were toxic, anything like that that you can share?
No, I just got a lot of bad press.
Why is that?
No one knew me. No one took the time to know who is Tony Pearson. It was just all the press I got was terrible. Go read it. It's still there. And that bothered me a lot. That inspired me to train even harder. I said, I'm going to let my body do the talking. I'm not going to say anything. So I remain quiet.
Now, one of the things that did happen to you, that because, look, you were put in a spot, if I remember the information correctly, you were put in a spot where you had to decide that you were going to go and do guest posing and make money somewhere else besides the IFBB.
Yes.
And it almost sounded like you got railroaded there for quite a few years. And I thought that was just absolute bullshit.
Yeah, I got a life suspension.
Life suspension.
Right. And within a couple of years, because I went to Europe and I won a few shows, and then I wrote a letter and I got reinstated and took it from there. So.
Well, you know, the harsh reality of life, I think, is that sometimes that kind of stuff, because you think, how can, you know, listen, I knew Weider. I met with him because I did a lot of advertising in his magazine for years there, 4 and 5 page articles, and I met with Joe.
Right.
But yet, you know, so I'm just simply calling it how it is here. How can somebody, and yet people do it all the time. Look, you're not going to give me the opportunity. And if I'm wrong about this, correct me, but you're not going to give me the opportunity to make any money. So you want to keep me down here and starve. What the fuck do you think I'm supposed to do? You know? And yet the minute I do something like that, you know, to make my, to become better, you're going to squash me.
Right, so
that really bugged me a lot, and yet the life is sometimes it's like that, Tony. I mean, and you bounce back from that,
right?
But how was that during that time? That you even had a judge, I think, that told you, "Look, you're never going to win." Even like when you got reinstated,
Yes.
You're not going to win more, you know, past third place. It's like, what the hell, man? Really?
Yes, yes.
Are we holding grudges there or what?
Yeah. A grudge for what, though?
For what?
I had to make a living.
Exactly.
Starving.
It's not like you were, like, making all this money with them and you decided that you wanted to be greedy and go make more, for goodness sake.
I was Mr. American homeless again.
Oh, God.
Yes.
And that made my jaw really, you know, I was pissed.
People don't know I went homeless again.
God, man.
And I thought, when Mr. America going to get me over to the moon, going to take me to the sky.
Sometimes reality is, you know, what people see and what the reality is totally different, right?
I wrote about that, how low I got after that. I really went down depression.
Here I am, Mr. America, and I'm over here homeless.
Yes.
Wow.
There was a prediction I was going to make $250,000 after winning Miss America.
Really?
I read that somewhere. And I go, yeah, I was living in my roommate's mom's house. That's where I was living.
My goodness. So then, okay. So then how did you, again, you keep overcoming these damn obstacles, you know? It's like, damn. Again, you're such an example and a testament to, I keep saying, you know, along the way in life, I come across things that just, I keep repeating it myself sometimes. It's like motivation has to be greater than the obstacle, because yes, life is going to test you constantly, one way or the other.
Right.
So how did you overcome that? And what was your next step then? Okay. So you did all these, and you also met a girl while you were in Europe too, a dancer, right?
Yes. I mean,
like really in love with her.
Yeah. That came on. That came later. That came.
Oh, it did.
So okay. Once I got reinstated, I'm back in IVB. I got this horrible infamous news that I'm never going to win. But I said, from that moment, I said to myself, okay, I'm not a competitor anymore. I'll make some money. I got to survive. Yeah. So I would compete, get in shape, show up, knowing where my place was going to be already. But I could make a little bit of money. And I could do seminars and I can do exhibitions. So just to scrape by. So right. I was not a competitor. Of course, I wanted to win.
Of course.
I became, you know, just, it's a living. I'm just going to make a living. That's what I said. Right. That's what kept me in the game. I could have walked away and never competed again.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I want to stick around. And I love what I do. I enjoy the stage. I can perform. I'll be in shape and take my place. And so every time I would lose at a show, I would just smile and wave at the audience.
What were you really thinking behind your head? What were you thinking?
I would go back to the gym, beat down my training partners again.
That you took it out on them.
Absolutely.
Here's what I think about third place.
Yeah. Yeah. So okay. I never said a word.
So at this point, then, were you still then training at Gold? Were you still a member at Gold's Gym?
I was still a member at Gold's Gym, but once I got the suspension, you know, I ended up leaving Gold's Gym because I went to Europe. So 79, 80, I was in Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I won, you know, the World and Universe in London and Italy. And yeah.
That's where you met Serge Nabre, right? I mean, he was putting on, didn't he put on a show over there, a world show?
Yes, it's WABA.
WABA.
His own federation. So I won Mr. World in his federation.
Yeah. And this these were all pro events, I assume.
Yeah, that was amateur.
Oh, that was amateur.
That was amateur.
And so at that point, then you were just making your money off seminars and guest posings and then still competing in the amateur there.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And I also competed in Dan Lurie's.
I remember him.
Yeah, the WWE. I won Mr. World there.
Yeah.
Pro. So, yeah, once I got reinstated, that was, like I said, I left Gold's Gym. I had to leave.
Yeah.
Where the money took us, where I had to go.
Well, yeah. Hell yeah, man.
Living out of a suitcase, put it that way.
Yeah. How many years were you in then? Were you still living in the States, but you were just doing a lot of traveling over in Europe, or did you actually have somewhere you're staying?
Yeah, I was still in the States, back and forth.
So how many times a year were you over in Europe doing all this stuff?
It depends. You know, you might go for a couple of weeks or 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
Yeah.
As much as you can, come home and back to security job and whatever you could do. A little television work. I dabbled in that in Hollywood a little bit.
Yeah.
So just to survive. I mean, it was just a survival mode. It's crazy. Yeah. But I would love what I was doing. I love competing. I love working out. You know, I love being on stage. Yeah. I love the show.
So, and you know what? You're still, based on where you came from, it was still a better gig.
Exactly.
You know, it wasn't ideal, but it was a better gig.
But see, in my before this book, I knew where I came from.
Yeah.
So no one else, now they know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was very motivated.
Yeah. Yeah. In a real deep way, you know, that nobody knew about.
Exactly. So okay. This is the problem with most people today as an adults. We still deal with childhood issues.
Yeah.
And you don't reveal these things to no one.
Right.
So that's another reason I kind of wrote the book, to inspire people to tell their story, share their story, you know, in a way of finding closure in their own lives.
Yeah. And you know something, Tony, when I know that we all know that when somebody else, because so many of us think sometimes that we're alone in that journey. And as bad as it was for you, there are obviously other people that were living the nightmare that you were.
Exactly. You are not alone.
You're not alone. And it's always nice.
Yes.
When somebody like yourself says, look, I was that person. And, you know,
that was me.
That was you.
I still look at this picture on this book and try to figure out how can I save this kid?
Yeah. Isn't that something?
I see that face and I go, that was me. But my heart goes out. How can I go save that kid?
Yeah. There was so much being told in that shot right there that you just showed us that.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. I hate to say this. Someone told me this is a cheap cover.
Cheap. Really?
Yes. It's a unique cover. It's unique.
Yeah.
And it's very personal.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's just
they have no idea. It's like, you know, I talked to somebody the other day on Instagram because I showed them an Instagram about Platts and the way we used to train, the loose style training. And some idiot that doesn't, you know, they expose themselves all the time. They're in bad form. I said, you know, it's more bad form is this is more than meets the eye. You don't have any idea, you idiot, that said that's a cheap cover. What's going on there? Obviously, you can't see the pain and see that, you know, obviously you can't see that because you're an idiot and you're inexperienced and fuck off.
Right. Well, the reason for that is the cover should be expensive. You can't judge the book by the cover. Yeah. That's what I wanted to say.
Right.
A lot, like you judge people by the outside appearance.
Exactly.
It's a lot deeper. People see me and they see me in a different light. Once they get to know me, they say, oh, you're different.
Yeah.
I like to stay inside of a box and like to keep you in the box.
Right.
I only stepped outside of the box. I'm not in the box.
Yeah.
But you're more creative when you're outside of the box.
You better believe it.
I had a vision for this picture. And my sister, I have never seen this picture before. My sister found it, the ones in the book, and sent it to me.
Really?
I said, God sent me the picture. Thank you. There it is.
Hey, I want to ask you, so that time during Europe, so all the stuff that you did in Europe was amateur. You never did any pro events in Europe?
I won the Pro Universe in London.
Okay, so you did, was that the only one or the first pro that you did?
First pro I won, and then I won Dan Lurie's pro, Mr. World.
Okay.
Yes.
And then, so when you came back, I mean, you're obviously
pro,
IFBB. Right. And didn't your sister visit you along this way here?
Yeah.
Visit you? So what was that all about?
No, she would always find me. She visited me much later. She came to Vegas and hung out with me. But she would always find me, like when my dad passed.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't go home for the funeral. I wrote about that.
Yeah.
So one, I couldn't afford it.
Right.
My relationship with him, you know, how that went.
Exactly. But let me ask you this, okay? Because, you know, my parents were divorced and there's some bullshit that went on between my parents. You know, I forgave them. And, you know, at some point, if you don't, as far as I'm concerned, then that baggage keeps just staying on you. You know, once I was able to let go of that, I couldn't understand why I didn't do that earlier. But I think it's just a timing thing.
Yes.
But when your dad passed like that, was there a part of you that felt really bad or sorrowful that you didn't go to his funeral, even though that all this stuff that happened?
Yes, I was very depressed about a year about that, at least a year.
Yeah.
And the last time I saw him, I knew I would never see him again.
Isn't that funny?
I left.
I mean, it's not funny. Yeah.
I was crying when I left.
Yeah.
Because in my heart, I knew I would never see him again, and it turned out to be true.
Yeah.
I'm in California. No one knew where I was. My sister found. She sent the LAPD to my door.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Where the hell are you here?
Right. Your dad died and they turned and walked away. So,
oh, God.
Yeah, just like that. Man. So, yeah, I was very devastated, even though I had a girlfriend at the time. She goes, you know, that's, you know, it's the only dad you have.
Yeah.
she explained about her dad, and you'll get over, you'll find some closure to it. So that really bothered me a lot.
I would imagine that it would, Tony, even though, you know, there's some horrible things that were done there.
He's the dad you have.
That's right.
Yes, he was a jerk. He was a bad guy. He was a mean guy.
Yeah.
But I didn't choose him.
Right.
So, yeah.
I know. This is where you and I had, you know, some similar. Mine was more with my mother, you know, okay. the way. And you know something, Tony, here's the thing that I guess the way I finally came to grips with all this was like two things. One, my mom at some point became, she got really authentic with me. And this was like probably 4 years before she passed away. And she said, you know something, it was the first time that I thought my mom was really authentic. Because I thought up to this point, you know, she had a lot of anger because my parents went through a divorce. But there's more to it to that. They were young when they got married. It's all kind of stuff, you know. And I just came to grips with, you know what? What she did was not a good thing. And what my dad did sometimes, what they did wasn't a good thing. But you know what? They did, at that point, they did the best that they could, even though it wasn't that good.
Right.
But they did the best that they could.
They could, right.
You know, because I think that's a way to start letting go of this anger and this shit that you just can't let go, right?
Right.
It's awful. And then my mom, she finally just said, you know, one day, Tony, she said, I'm really sorry for any pain that I caused you. Fuck, game over. You know, she meant it.
Yes. Tony, and you knew she meant it. She knew it. Yeah.
Did you have that moment like with your mom, or you went back and actually visited, I think, your mom one more time, right?
Yes. No, I made up with my mom. So we got back together and she's like my best friend and still is.
So she's still alive.
Yeah. Oh, she's gonna be 88 this year.
Wow.
Yeah. So for what, 20 some years, I didn't see my mom.
Oh my goodness.
From age 2 until 23, maybe.
So I know that like when you first, there was some apprehension when you first were going back to see your mom. I mean, rightfully so.
Because you don't know how to react or what to say, what to do.
Talk about awkward.
You don't know this person.
Talk about awkward.
They don't know you.
Isn't that weird to feel that way with a parent, that you feel awkward and all this tension and don't know how to act? Isn't that weird?
Yeah, you don't know what to say.
Yeah.
But so I'm glad you said about the anger that's built up inside until your mom said that to you. And that's what another reason for this book, because once you release that, you're free.
Yep.
You kind of free yourself and you have to forgive them.
Yep.
Auntie Betty, I forgave her and I go, oh, I would never.
Right.
I do this all the time. Oh, no way. I go, I did it for myself.
Exactly.
I have to live on.
Exactly. And for those people that have never gone through what you went through, even like my stuff that I went through was nowhere near, as far as I'm concerned, what you went through, but it's still, it caused problems. It caused baggage. And this is why I kept asking myself after I said I finally forgave them. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, why couldn't I have done that sooner, Tony? How come I had to carry this shit all the way through? I carried this till I was 41. I won't forget it. I was in my 40s. Right. And then finally I was able to let go. And I thought to myself, why the hell did I just flip that switch, you know, many years earlier?
I forgive you and keep walking. Yes.
Why not? Why didn't I do that? Why I can't even answer the question still.
You're saving yourself. Yes.
You know?
But a lot of people do that. As adults, they carry this stuff all their whole lives.
They do, man.
And they never let it go.
It's awful. So
I hope this would inspire people to say, okay, Tony Pearson told his story. I can tell mine.
Well, listen, if somebody's not inspired by the story that you told in this thing, I mean, they shouldn't be around as far as I'm concerned, because that was a great testament of human spirit. And man, I want to talk about now, because this is kind of where it gets a little bit towards the end. You're in Vegas now. Now you're doing all this personal training. You end up going to Hefner's mansion. I mean, were you in Vegas when that happened? You had all these places. No,
living in L.A. I still live in L.A.
Okay, and all of a sudden you started hanging out with some major players, huh?
Yes, big famous model. And we're still friends. I just saw him a couple of weeks ago.
Is that Fabio? Is that the guy you're talking about? Because you mentioned him. Yeah.
Still my friend.
And then
when
did you decide to move to Vegas and why?
I you know, when it was 2000, 2001, I said, I'm going to move to Vegas. Sean Ray, he had a condo here. And Sean Ray says, hey, reasonable prices over there. The weather's great and close to LA. And I said, you know, I had enough for LA. I was tired of LA. That's part of it, really. Yeah. I mean, the traffic and LA's a tough place to live.
It is, actually, you know.
And I just wanted to get out.
Yeah.
You know, coming from the South, I'm a, you know, Southern boy, and I just wanted to get out of LA for a while.
Yeah.
Then I moved over here, and I liked it right away. Diana Dennis, you know who that is?
Yep,
She's a pro bodybuilder.
Yeah, I do.
She's the only person I knew in Las Vegas.
Is that right? Did you guys do some mixed you in part of your book, you did some mixed competing with some ladies, right?
With Carla Dunlap, Juliet Bergman, Tina Bergman. Black, and Jerry.
She was big in the Netherlands, right?
Yes. She won the Olympia. She won the Olympia.
Yeah.
Diana Dennis used to compete against me in those mixed pairs.
Oh, really?
She had her partner. Yeah. Quite often, yeah.
No kidding.
Yeah, so I knew her, and she helped me out. I moved to Vegas, and thank God I did, you know, because once again, those miracle things that happened. You read the part about my health.
Yes.
The problems that I had, my back and my knees.
Exactly.
And this and that.
Yeah.
To the point I couldn't walk.
You met a guy over there in Vegas that did some stuff, right? Yeah.
Yes, I was crippled. So after the career, see, the career destroyed me. I took my body beyond the limit.
Yeah.
Mentally, I'm stronger than I am physically. Yeah. So I pushed through all the pain with a bum knee. You know, I had a whole career with a bum knee.
Right. Wrestling injury, right? Yeah. Right.
Yeah. My knee still hurts. Today, it still hurts. So, but I made a career out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Just
endure the pain.
I met
this guy.
Go ahead, yeah.
So I met this guy, and he says, I do what you call chi. He's into this karate, his 6 degree black belt, and I can release scar tissue from your muscles. And I go, oh, yeah, sure. I'm from LA. I heard it all. So,
yeah, right.
So a year later, he came back. I was very stubborn. He goes, you should come to me one time, and he walks away. And I go, okay, I'll go once. What the hell? He started working on me, and he got me back on stage.
Unbelievable.
He got me back in 2014. So from 2002-2003 until 2014, it took me that long to heal my body.
Yeah.
Even though I never stopped training, but I was in pain the whole time.
Yeah. Now, is that guy still
in? Yeah. Is
he still around?
Yes, he's still around. Yes.
And then Diana Dennis also still around?
Yes. She's still the personal trainer. Yep.
In the gym that you're training in? Is that where she's
before,
at?
Before, yes. So the gym switched over now, so she's at a different gym now. But yeah, we're still friends, so.
Yeah. So then what are you doing these days now? Now, what's Tony Pearson's life, the day in the life of Tony? What does that look like now?
Personal training all day long, as much as I can.
Yeah.
So.
You do any guest posing? I mean, you still look great. So do you do anything like that anymore?
No, I do want to compete one more time, though. So I competed in 2014, won the Grand Masters, USA. So at 63, I'll be turning 64. I would like to compete one more time. Guest posing, probably not.
Which event do you want to compete in again?
I don't know yet. I've got to find something.
Yeah.
Because I'm in decent shape. I'm still in shape. So.
Oh, yeah. You're underselling yourself. You're better than in decent shape, man. Seriously. I came back and did one, and I was 56 when I came back. I would have done it more, but I had some health issues that I knew for sure if I did it again, it would kill me, like legit. It would put me out, you know.
Yes.
At that point, I knew that I had to make a choice on that. But otherwise, I would still be competing. I think we talked about this last time, was that the thing is really that I've seen in the industry that is, I think, that is enlightening, if nothing else, is that more and more people are competing at older ages. I mean, what I saw, like in the last time I went back and competed in the show that I competed in, it was the Old Timers Nationals, Pittsburgh. I mean, there were like legit bodies in the 60-year-old groups. You know, it wasn't just one or two people.
Yes.
You know, so that was good to see.
No.
Yeah. You know, that was good to see.
Yes.
You know, but otherwise, you know, I think that, you know, it's obvious to me, at least I think it's obvious that someone like you is, we called that when I was in Venice Beach, is living the bodybuilding lifestyle. I think till, still to a degree you are. I am. I still live the what I think is a bodybuilding lifestyle, you know, training and eating.
Train every day.
Yeah, I still
diet.
Yeah, I've told people at my gym, I said, you know, they're gonna have to take me out of this thing feet first because I just keep going back. You know? I just get up in the morning. Yeah. I get up in the morning at 3 o'clock like an idiot and get down there, and because I'm so regimented and trained, and you know, repetition is the mother of skill. I took it to a whole nother level, I think. I still get up and do that kind of stuff, man. But I'm not happy if I don't.
That's amazing.
You know?
That's amazing.
I know Tom Platz, he would make comments like, it's like going back home. You know, the gym to me is like going back home. Do you feel the same way?
Home. Yes. You're home. I can't function. I got to work out.
Yeah, exactly.
Every day. Sometimes twice a day.
Yeah. Is there another book in your future, you think?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe, you know, a workout book, training book.
Yeah. Because obviously you can speak from a very powerful position. What about those 1,800 kids, and it's probably more now, that are dying every year? What about something? Have you thought about being an advocate for that group of people? I mean, your book is doing that.
Yeah.
But I mean, actually pressing the
right. Yeah, that's what I'm hoping to do, be an advocate for the kids, save our kids.
Yeah.
And I can't, you know, when no one's speaking about this, you don't hear anything about this. And this is happening every day. And the suicide rate for teens and young adults is at the highest than ever.
Is that right?
Because of depression, abuse.
Yeah.
There's so many things that, you know, they can't cope.
How much do you think social media is playing into that? Because I have my own opinion about that.
Huge.
Yeah, I think so.
Huge.
Too.
I think that's why they start showing the likes, because kids get so depressed because they're not getting the likes.
Right. Nobody likes.
They don't have the beautiful body, or they don't have this, and that, you know, yeah, it's devastating for them.
And you know what they don't see is that, you know, the people that put these filters on, and it's not what you really see. You know, and that's misleading to a young person.
Yes, their young minds. These are teenagers.
Yeah.
And yet, the suicide is at the highest it's ever been.
Unbelievable. Well, you know something, it's that, and what goes along with that is obesity is out of control.
Right, true.
You know, and that just plays all into that stuff, right?
Yeah. So in my book, I wrote about how I tried to commit suicide.
That's right.
Yeah. Hey, once again, I've survived it. But yeah, because the whole world came to an end for me.
Yeah.
A combination of my childhood, IVB. Nothing was working.
Yeah.
And you lose touch. You have nowhere to turn. There's no outlet. There's no help coming. So hopefully I can inspire some kids that, you know, you can be a winner. You can survive.
So let me ask you this, because obviously I've never quite understood how, when somebody gets that low, you know, obviously you're not in an objective state of mind.
No.
When you get to that point. But Tony, how did you not take that last step and end it? What pulled you out of it?
I don't know. Well, the girlfriend I had at the time found me, rushed me to the hospital. And then I came out of that. Within the same year, I won Mr. Universe, though.
God.
I do have a will to fight back, but sometimes you hit those moments where you're so low that you just can't get out of it. You're trying to get out of your own skin.
Yeah.
You're that depressed. You're that anxiety is that high that you're trying to escape from yourself.
Yeah. I remember one time I thought about it, to be honest with you. And I was driving a car and I thought, if I could just muster up enough guts to drive this bitch off the cliff.
Yep.
But you know, I didn't, and I'm glad I didn't, but you know, it's just really weird. And I think, look, I think if we're just being really honest, I think that it's not unusual necessarily to have dark thoughts like that. You know, I don't think it is really.
Not. A lot of people do.
You know, and that makes you feel even worse when it's like, how could you think that way? What are you fucking sick in the head? Yeah. Like, yeah, actually. But you know, it's kind of like, well, again, we talked about that. You're not the only one. Know this,
right.
Through this.
I know I'm not alone, and a lot of people that are listening to this, and I'm sure they can relate to a lot of what we're talking about.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, anyway. Hey, listen, man, You know, I hope that we talked about what you wanted to talk about today about your book. If there's anything that I'm sort of leaving out or that you want to mention, I mean, feel free. Now's the time to talk about it. But I just think that you'd walk this down that a path that gives me a good idea of who you are and what you went through.
I really appreciate it. No, it's I just hope people read the story. So I want to get outside of the bodybuilding. Once again, we're back in this box. I'm trying to get outside of the box of bodybuilding.
Yeah.
The world, all of America, you know, kids all over the world is dying from this abuse.
Yeah.
So I just want the whole world to read the book.
Yeah.
You know, people go, yeah, he's got a book. What is it, bodybuilding book? No, it's real life.
Real life, man.
And I'm a survivor. And that's the message. You can survive too. So if they go purchase the book, it's at TonyPearsonDriven.com. We'll go straight to Amazon and pick up a copy of it. I just want them to read it.
Yeah.
It's not about making money. At this point, I just want them to read the story.
And I will say this, your book is a big, big, thick book. And sometimes people get, you know, that drives them away because it's like, oh my God, all this reading. It's a fast read. It's a good read. It's an easy read. It really is.
Yes.
I agree.
Pages, but you could go through it like this.
Boom. Yes, I agree. Totally agree.
Right.
You know, because when I looked at it, I thought, oh, it's going to take me a while. But no, once I got into it, and of course, the story is compelling.
Okay.
It made it even faster. You know, so it's an easy read. It's an interesting read. And you're right. If somebody just opens to page 5 like I did, because I think that's the first page that you actually read.
Yes.
The minute I highlighted Aunt Betty, who was in like the first 4 words of your, I was like, fuck, I was on this.
What the hell is this?
I couldn't stop.
Right.
So I think that everybody should read this book.
It's going to be very shocking, put it that way.
Oh, God. Say the least. Anyway, listen, man, I really appreciate you coming on. One of the, I will never forget somebody like you, and I hope we cross paths again, you know, and I was so lucky to meet you at the Olympia because I always wanted to, and when the guy said you were there, I made it a point to go find you, and I tell you what, you're amazing. You're a true inspiration for me.
Thank you.
And I hope this book does really well for you because you deserve it.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it.
Okay, hey, man.
Tell me about his follow me on Instagram, TonyPearson87, Twitter, same thing, TonyPearson87, and TonyPearsonDriven.com.
Nice.
Pick up a copy.
Sounds good. Hey, by the way, I think you look really great in a suit. And I'm going to say, because I'm really narcissistic and full of myself, I think I look just a little bit better maybe in the dark than you do in your suit. You look fucking fantastic.
Thank you.
you take care of yourself.
Yes, sir.
If you ever want to collaborate down the road on some stuff, you know, that'd be an honor for me. But in the meantime, go get them, man.
Okay.
All right.
I will.
Okay, Tony.
Thank you.
See ya. Bye now.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Thanks for listening to the Serious Growth Podcast. For more episodes like the one you just listened to, subscribe to us on your mobile podcast app and leave us a review. If you'd like to reach out, you can find us online at seriousgrowth.com. Until next time, train smart and train hard.